what goes into that analysis?
Yeah, our index actually has 26 policies across three big themes, and those themes are wages, worker protections, and rights to organize. So the way we measure states is across all 26 areas. So that does include everything from minimum wages and tipped wages to paid leave and scheduling protections to also the ability for public and private workers to organize and collectively bargain.
It seems like some of the worst states, maybe all of them, are in the South. Any progress there at all?
The South is very consistent in terms of ending up at the bottom of our index, but there has been some important changes that have happened that I do like to highlight. A few years ago, there was a ballot initiative in Florida that passed by a very strong margin, which raised the minimum wage for the state. And as a result of that ballot initiative, which really was the voice of the people, because voters themselves put the initiative on, Florida moved up in our rankings. And another example that we really love to sort of lift up as an example of something that's great is Virginia jumped up our rankings pretty significantly since we started this index in 2018. When we first released the index, Virginia was at the very bottom, and now it's in the top half. And that's the result of a lot of great policies that were passed due to workers organizing and voters really advocating for a change. And policies that passed in Virginia that really impacted its ranking were a higher minimum wage, a domestic workers' bill of rights, the ability for public teachers to collectively bargain in the state. So change is very, very possible, and it's always very exciting to see when it happens.
Can a state move up in the rankings because certain cities pass progressive legislation, or does it have to be something that's done statewide?
It has to be at the state level. This index only looks at the state level and doesn't look locally. So there are certainly cities that even outperform the state where they are in, even if the state performs very well. But we're really only looking at the state level for this index.
How about right to work states? Any progress there? It seems, those states are very hard to organize in and make any progress in.
That's absolutely true. So this year, for the first time in decades, a state actually overturned its right to work law, which is Michigan. I believe that's the first time a state has overturned its right to work law since the 60s. So this was a huge win, a really huge moment. And that makes such a big difference. So in terms of movement overturning right to work laws, we are starting to see a little bit of a sea change, which is very exciting. But as you suggest, that policy on the books really makes a big difference in repressing organizing for workers and the ability for workers to collectively bargain.
Does the fact that we have a federal system actually hurt workers in a way, because states can really make their own laws and there's going to be an unevenness around the country?
Well, I would say this index provides an opportunity for states to improve the reality for workers and working families, but it really especially calls on the federal government to raise the standard for all workers. The system of governance that we have in this country says that while states can go beyond what is available at the federal level really does set the floor. So we expect and hope that this index can provide something of a map for the federal government to improve itself if there are those states that choose to stay stagnant or rely on federal standards, then this is an opportunity for the federal government to improve that standard.
So one of the factors that helps workers improve their lives is their ability to collectively bargain. As you look at the country, which states make it easiest to do that, and which states make it hardest?
So any state that does not have a so-called right to work law makes it easier for unions to exist and for workers to collectively bargain. But one of the things we did this year in our report was we took a look at the correlation between states that perform well on our index and states that have high rates of unionization. So unsurprisingly, those states that do not have a right to work law have much higher rates of unionization. And one of the great examples, actually, Hawaii has a very high rate of unionization amongst its workers. But really, the union difference is so important. We know that where unions exist, the pay gap is smaller, there are greater protections for workers, and they can ask for more flexibility. It makes a big difference in terms of helping all workers, but especially women and especially workers of color.
In states where there are more rights for unions, does that put upward pressure on non-union employers? Or is the union movement just not strong enough to do that?
I think it depends, to be honest, on the sector. I think it depends on the state. Some states are more reliant on some sectors and industries than others. There are states for which agricultural workers are hugely important to their economy, and the challenges for agricultural workers to unionize and collectively bargain are much higher than other sectors as a result of the National Labor Standards Act that created the ability for workers to organize in the 1930s. So I think it really depends on what the state is and what the workers are, but we are seeing a huge change in terms of popular support for unionization and collectively bargaining, which is really exciting, and it makes a very big difference. So I think it's a situation of watching this space.
Any legislation on the national level that needs to be overturned in order to make it easier for workers to organize?
I don't know about overturning. I would say there's some really great bills at the federal level that, if passed, would make a really big difference. And the number one bill that comes to mind is the PRO Act, or the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which this year was named for Richard Trumka. And that is a bill that, if passed, would allow all workers, regardless of the state where they live, to have greater access to the ability to organize and to collectively bargain. So there are great opportunities for change, and those opportunities have already been written and presented to Congress. It's just a matter of congressional representatives taking those opportunities and really passing that legislation.
Did any of your research involve undocumented workers and how they're faring? Did they figure into this at all?
Certainly. So we don't have any policies in this index that specifically speaks towards, or rather targets, undocumented workers. But there are policies in our index that, if they do exist, they certainly benefit undocumented workers. And some of those have to do with farm workers. There are a lot of undocumented workers that work in the agricultural industry. There are some states that have passed provisions for all agricultural workers without specification of their documented status. There are also states that have a domestic worker bill of rights. Not all, but many domestic workers can sometimes be undocumented. And the reality is that where there is this robust policies in support of workers and working families, many of those policies don't have caveats suggesting that they should only apply to documented workers. It is rather an application to employees. So that doesn't have a specification of documented status.
That was Caitlin Henderson of Oxfam American speaking with KBOO's David Rosenberg about the recent edition of the Best States to Work report. If you're just tuning in, this is KBOO News in Depth. As of Sunday morning, Kaiser Permanente Pharmacy Workers, UFCW Local 555, are on strike. They will be for the next 21 days over unfair labor practices. Last week, KBOO's Althea Billings spoke to Aurora Biggers, a freelance reporter with street roots, about her reporting on the strike. Let's listen.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Aurora Biggers, a freelancer with street roots, about her new article. It's called KP to Outsource Union Work During Pending Pharmacy Strike. UCFW pharmacy workers filed numerous unfair labor practice claims against the healthcare giant since 2021, await new contract. Welcome to the show, Aurora.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. So your new article discusses unionized Kaiser pharmacy workers planning to go on strike along with other unionized employees of Kaiser. But let's start with this strike authorization. What is motivating the UCFW 555 pharmacy workers to go on strike?
Yeah, so since 2021, UFCW Local 555 has filed a number of unfair labor practice charges against Kaiser. Those charges include things like the Kaiser failing to provide information regarding bargaining and grievances, Kaiser attempting to directly bargain with workers instead of negotiating issues at the bargaining table, and also trying to dictate who the union elects as their shop stewards.
Can you explain what unfair labor practice charges entail and how it relates to the strike and the contract?
So an unfair labor practice charge is basically a complaint that workers could file, whether you're represented by a union or not, with the National Labor Relations Board, basically saying that your employer has violated some form of your, you know, labor rights. And these specific charges regarding, you know, what seems to be Kaiser trying to either not respond to the union or go over the union's head to deal directly with employees are both things that are considered illegal by the National Labor Relations Board and also the Federal Services Labor Management Relations Act, because they can impede bargaining if you are a union worker and you're in the middle of contract negotiations. They can also have what's called a chilling effect on workers who are maybe looking to organize, or they can also just create unsafe or unhabitable work environments for workers. In this particular situation, these unfair labor practice charges that have racked up over the number of years, some, you know, have incurred during contract bargaining. Some of them are not necessarily related to contract bargaining, but they're something that the union says has continued to happen and is not stopping, regardless of the fact that they have filed these charges with the National Labor Relations Board. And it's reached a point where they've decided that it's necessary. Workers voted 99% in support of this strike. They've decided that it's necessary to go on strike to tell the company that these unfair labor practices have to stop. Now, separate from this, but, you know, related in the background, is these ongoing contract negotiations. So the contract, you know, is about to expire, and one of the primary issues that they're bargaining over is wages related to, and that's related to staffing levels, which are really common issues in the healthcare industry right now. So while the strike itself is not over the contract negotiations, it's solely focused on these unfair labor practices, reaching an agreement with Kaiser could be one way to avert the strike or even shorten it if they were to reach an agreement after the strike has already started.
So these workers are looking at a 3-week strike in October. What kind of an impact is that expected to have on Kaiser pharmacies and facilities?
The impact is, you know, poised to potentially be really considerable, as the bargaining unit is almost 400 workers. So almost 400 workers are preparing to go on strike, and this is at dozens and dozens of Kaiser facilities across the Portland metro area, down the I-5 corridor, and in Southwest Washington. You know, this is not just the pharmacy where you go to pick up your prescriptions. It's also the mixing labs. It's also the warehouses. It's the postal prescription service areas. So it would be a pretty significantly wide reach that would impact Kaiser. Now, Kaiser has said that they are planning to outsource this union work. So where these union workers would usually have work because they're going on strike, Kaiser has decided to outsource that work to local community pharmacies, which is something that is pretty unusual for large healthcare giants to do. And is also something that would be typically considered a form of strike-breaking activity, because they're replacing this union work with non-union workers.
What has been the union's reaction to that strategy or finding out about it?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and certainly a question I have. I reached out to the union a few days ago, but have not received a response from them on what their perspective is on Kaiser choosing to outsource their labor. So that's to be determined, and we'll have to see. I know in a lot of spheres, I think people are used to seeing strikes happen and hearing the phrase of don't cross the picket line. UFCW is certainly really familiar with having strikes at grocery stores. That's one of the primary sectors that they unionize in. And that's definitely a situation where they, you know, would not support, most likely would not support the companies bringing in what's quote unquote scab workers to replace union work, and would also try to dissuade community members from shopping at those grocery stores during the strike. But it can be a little bit different in the healthcare industry. It's one of the reasons why they give an ample amount of time to notify the employer so the employer can make arrangements to ensure that, you know, the healthcare is able to be continued for patients. you know, in talking with UFCW, they certainly don't want patients to defer healthcare for the sake of, you know, not doing business with Kaiser. So, you know, we'll have to see what their perspective is on Kaiser choosing to outsource labor. But I do know that their main intention with the strike is not to cause any harm to patients, but simply to send a message to the company that says, hey, if you want to do this work, you're going to have to find another way to get it done without the union workers.
Well, earlier you mentioned contract negotiations and how those might factor into if a strike happens and how long it could happen. What are the things that workers are looking for in an agreement?
Yeah, one of the primary issues, and I don't know the full details of what the negotiations are, but one of the primary issues is certainly wages. And where it gets a little bit hairy is that, you know, the union is saying that Kaiser is offering well below market wages. And that's causing widespread staffing issues because it doesn't make Kaiser a very competitive employer on the hiring market. So there's not enough staffing to maintain safe levels and to provide proper medical care to patients. Patients are having to wait months for medical care, and workers themselves are becoming burnt out with the workload. But on the other side of things, Kaiser is saying, no, actually, we offer above market wages. Kaiser said that they have a quote-unquote philosophy of offering 10% above market in its wages. Kaiser didn't offer like what their wages are currently or how they have ensured that they're offering 10% above market, and UFCW also didn't provide the current numbers that are being tossed around at the bargaining table. But UFCW has been a part of what's called a coalition of Kaiser unions, which is a group of local Kaiser workers represented by local unions across the nation. And UFCW is, you know, currently trying to step out of the coalition so that they can bargain locally. But the nationwide coalition is working on their own contract, which would cover all of the Kaiser workers that are represented by local unions that are a part of this coalition. And they've said that Kaiser is offering for the Northwest what is about a 2% annual raise in wages. And they say this is not enough to compete with rising cost of living or what the market level is right now to maintain staffing. So that's definitely one of their primary concerns. I'm not really aware of what some of their other concerns they might have are in bargaining right now, but I know that's kind of their primary focus at the moment.
I think you also mentioned staffing issues, understaffing. I guess those kind of play in together.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the reasons, you know, aside from obviously cost of living and wanting to make sure these workers are being compensated well, it's also definitely contributing to these understaffing conditions that are super prominent in pretty much every healthcare sphere in the U.S. right now. And because there's not what, you know, these workers say is an appropriate amount of staffing, whether, and this is not an issue that's isolated to the pharmacy sphere, this is an issue that's kind of taken over every sphere of healthcare right now. Because understaffing is such a large problem, you're seeing these really long wait times for patients to receive medical care. You're also seeing a lot of workers burn out, leave the industry, or go to different health systems that are offering better wages and have better staffing levels. And so that's one of the main issues that UFCW has pointed to, is that workers at Kaiser don't really have to stay with Kaiser. The wages are not high enough for them to be incentivized to stay with the company, so they're going elsewhere. And that's definitely contributing to these understaffing issues that they're seeing, which just makes it a not great work environment if you're also burnt out because you're handling more than you're intended to handle because your company is not able to hire or is not choosing to hire enough staff.
Well, Kaiser is also facing strike authorizations from other bargaining units within the company. What can you tell me about how that plays in?
Yeah, definitely. So since UFCW has historically been a part of this coalition, but is, you know, requesting to leave so that they can bargain their own separate contract, you know, they don't directly factor in, but definitely Kaiser is feeling the pressure on all fronts here at a national level, because not only are UFCW Local 555 here in the Portland area getting ready to strike, but also their nationwide bargaining unit that represents workers in Hawaii, California, Washington, Colorado, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. And there's also another bargaining unit in Portland through SEIU that are all also getting ready to strike. And their strike would be around the same time, it would be between October 4th and October 7th, and it's also an unfair labor practice strike for a lot of the same issues that UFCW Local 555 has cited. So Kaiser's feeling this pressure on a local level, but, you know, whether they are able to avert this strike or not, they do also have this impending strike that's going to hit them. And in Oregon, SEIU, I think, handles around 4,800 Kaiser workers who'd be preparing to go on strike around the same time and overlapping with this UFCW strike as well.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't cover?
No, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being with us. I've been speaking with Aurora Biggers, a freelancer with Street Roots, about her new article. It's called KP to Outsource Union Work During Pending Pharmacy Strike. UCFW pharmacy workers filed numerous unfair labor practice claims against the healthcare giant since 2021, await a new contract. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. Having a baby makes it much more likely that you'll go into medical debt. At least, that's the conclusion of a recent study in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. Aisha Sundaram is an internal medicine resident at the Cambridge Health Alliance at Harvard Medical School and was part of the team that did the study. She spoke with KBOO's David Rosenberg about the study and its significance and what can be done about the problem.
There have been plenty of studies that have been done about people going into medical debt with other comorbidities. And there have been anecdotal studies about surprise pregnancy costs out there, but I think there hasn't been one explicitly saying there's an association.
How does that work? Is it that the medical plans don't cover the pregnancy care that goes on? And what's going on there?
So I think a couple of factors. One of the, I think, biggest points of our study is that the increased likelihood of medical debt was there regardless of insurance status. So I think particularly of surprise to me was that even people with private insurance were having a risk of medical debt. And I think some of that can be attributed to one difference in billing and sort of the surprise costs with ways things are billed. And then also the deductibles getting higher and higher, especially over the last 10 to 15 years. The other component is with Medicaid, usually pregnancy costs are covered during the actual partum period, but then postpartum, the costs are covered up until 60 days, according to federal law. And that's something that we feel could use a lot of improvement, especially because we know that costs continue even further down the road with supplies and childcare and other follow-up visits, for not just for the baby, but also for the mother if they have comorbid conditions associated with pregnancy. So I think that also contributes to the cost.
Is this something that's unique to the U.S. among so-called advanced industrial countries?
Yes, unfortunately, it very much is. We appear to be the country that has one of the highest maternal mortalities in the world, as well as the ones with the highest cost. And that's compared to industrialized nations in Europe, where a lot more of the costs during the partum and postpartum periods are covered, and we could do well to learn from those countries.
So the problem can be alleviated, would you say, with some simple fixes, or is it a more complicated process?
As I was alluding to, one of the fixes is state by state, but extending the Medicaid coverage period. I know, for example, in Massachusetts, we've had proposals that have already been submitted to court trying to extend it from 60 days to 6 to 12 months. And so that's something we would advocate for. I think in the longer run, if we're looking to try and fix things like deductibles and surprise costs, that would be more of changing the system to reflect the ones in other industrialized nations that have universal coverage. But especially, I think, for the period of pregnancy.
When you talk about surprise costs, what would be some examples of that?
So some of the examples that I've, you know, personally seen in not just my patients, but also looking at the news are things like tiered billing. So, for example, if someone comes into the emergency room and then from the emergency room, they get admitted to a labor and delivery floor, they can sometimes be billed for that very brief amount of time that they spend in the emergency room. Even if they didn't receive care, it was just from passing there. They can also get surprise costs from, again, very hospital dependent, but things like having the baby on the chest the Tylenol or Motrin that they get for pain relief, is the costs are much, much higher sometimes in billing than they should be just from getting it over the counter. So things like that are, you know, very dependent on which state it's in and which hospital it's in, but those are all things that can contribute.
The interventions necessary, is this something Congress could get involved in?
I think it's something that they should. There's always already been a lot of turnover with the health system and the Affordable Care Act having parts of it sort of removed and added. But with pregnancy in particular, I think it's something where even if it's extending like the Medicaid coverage period, it's something that would be, I think, the low-hanging fruit in my mind that could be fixed.
Yeah, sometimes we hear that people don't, this plays into the abortion issue as well, people don't want to have more children because they can't afford it. Do you ever hear people talking about not wanting to go through the pregnancy process because that's too expensive?
Absolutely. Yeah, and unfortunately, I think our study supports that because even when there's, you know, when a mother doesn't have comorbidities like hypertension and diabetes that play into other costs, just the act of having an uncomplicated birth, if that's enough to put you into medical debt, that's definitely something that affects a young woman's decision.
So are there differences from state to state on this issue, or is it really a matter of the kind of medical plans people have and how these hospitals operate?
So it seems like it's very much an across the board issue. And again, with our study, we did adjust for some of those factors like area, like household size, socioeconomic status, and insurance status to see if there would be any result that wasn't as significant, but that was not the case. It still ended up being very diffusely putting people in medical debt.
Well, I guess if you're more affluent, the debt is easier to pay. I don't know, but it's still debt.
But it's still debt. And I think that also, you know, there are definitely stories that have been reported where one person's first childbirth was mostly covered and other people's was not. And I think that speaks to just the change in our insurance over the years, as well as the change in private with the deductibles.
Is there anything that doctors could do individually with their patients to kind of make the situation a little better, or is it just too big a problem?
Well, I think one of the things we can do, again, is sort of the education and counseling from our standpoint about what exactly goes into pregnancy, and then as well as helping people with their decisions, giving them access to contraception. I know in some states that's definitely easier than others right now, but that's something we can definitely do in Massachusetts. And then I think it's important to also encourage doctors to be more active as community advocates. So, you know, no doctor should be closed off or dissuaded from going to the state house and being involved in promoting some of these bills that can extend Medicaid, for example, or advocate for abortion rights. So those are all things that we should be promoting, especially in states where that's much more restrictive.
From what you know, or from what you've heard about the single payer proposals, do you think any of those would help with this issue?
I think it would at least be a start in going towards universal coverage for pregnancy. Will that come in 5 years? I can't say, especially given the state of our country right now. But at the very least, I think it's something that can't be counted out, just given how much more successful our industrialized counterparts are.
That was Ayesha Sundaram of the Cambridge Health Alliance speaking with KBOO's David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. Consider supporting KBOO and programming like this during our fall membership drive. Donate and become a member today by going online to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. I'm Ender Black. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we are in the middle of our fall membership drive. Help us meet our $55,000 goal by making a contribution today. KBOO's organic, free-range, and independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting the word KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Our members continue to fertilize community.